Well, welcome once again as we continue the series that we're doing in the life of Joseph. And if you've been following it, you may remember that last time we looked at the journey of Joseph's dad, Jacob, or Israel, as he's sometimes called, and their whole family out of the promised land and down into Egypt. And as we went through that story, we really looked at the personal aspects, the applications that we can make for our own lives. This time, it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to be exploring the prophetic implications of our text. And this lesson actually comes from Genesis 47, just a few verses, verses 13 to 25. And it's interesting. It's a little bit different. There are parts of Scripture that are prophetic in nature, but they aren't really seen clearly until the time comes for their fulfillment. And this is one of those passages. You know, if I had studied this passage a few years ago, I don't think I would have seen what I see today. And no, it isn't because I'm now wiser or more in tune with God. It's just simply that recent events show how this passage could well find fulfillment in the coming days. This passage is about what happened in the 7-year famine that hit in the days of Joseph when he ruled in Egypt. And really it shows the following, and this is what we'll look at, how the food and the crops failed, how the people's money failed, how they lost their land and possessions, how they lost their freedom, and yet how they were apparently thankful that they hadn't lost their lives. Does that sound a little bit like you'll own nothing and be happy? Anyway, like I said, it's an interesting passage and it points prophetically to what will happen again. So we'll start by reading a good part of the passage and just add a little modern day application to it, and then we'll kind of break down the verses into more detail. So let me just read fairly much the whole thing. Genesis 47, 13 to 21 and 25. It says, "Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they brought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and they said, 'Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed.' Then Joseph said, 'Give your livestock and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone.' So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for their donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said, 'We will not hide from my lord that our money is gone, and my lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate.' Then Joseph brought all of the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into cities, from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other. And so they said, 'You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants.'" So that is the key passage, really, describing the 7-year famine in the days of Joseph. And you'll note that it begins with the food failing, then the money and the possessions failing, then the people becoming slaves or servants, and in the end, it simply has them being happy that they are still alive. Now, before we delve into it, we need to note some modern day predicted parallels. You've no doubt heard of the World Economic Forum, or the WEF. This was founded by Klaus Schwab in 1971, and it's a non-governmental lobbying organization that has trained a lot of the world leaders, and it holds a convention in Davos, Switzerland, each year. And here it sort of discusses the apparent problems and the solutions as they see them, facing this planet amongst the world's so-called elite. In 2016, it put out its predictions for 2030. And among them was the forecast that by 2030, you will own nothing and be happy. Now, we should note this is not a prophecy. It's simply a prediction of where they see the future going. And quite possibly where they want it to go. So here is what the prediction said again. By 2030, you will own nothing and be happy. Now bear in mind, however, when they say that you will own nothing, the emphasis is on the you. They're not talking about themselves, because the elites, they believe, will own everything. Now, if that were to occur, how would it come about? And let me be clear on something before we begin. I'm not saying, you know, what's 2030? This is simply a prediction by a worldly, though powerful, organization. But the Bible does tell us that in the last days, there will be a terrible famine and a powerful system of control over the people. And this passage before us in Genesis that speaks of the 7-year famine that happened back in the days of Joseph is a prophetic pointer to the last 7-year tribulation period that will come and test the entire world. So it's useful for us just to see the process of how it came about previously and whether this can give us any clues of how it will come about again. So let's have a look at this in a bit more detail. Where did it begin? We read in verse 13, "Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine." So we see that it begins with the food failing. Joseph had told Pharaoh that this day would come, and he'd prepared for it. You know, as we've seen in previous lessons, after the 7 years of plenty came the 7 year of famine. They knew that it was coming. So we could probably ask, well, what causes a famine? If you put in "what causes a famine" into a search engine, you'll see a combination of factors, such as the following: war and conflict destroying crops and disrupting food distribution. Pestilence and plant disease can cause famine. Insect infestations causing large-scale crop failure. Climate impacts, such as floods or hail or droughts through excessive heat. The WEF actually says that we are on the brink of a polycrisis. That's their word for it, a polycrisis. It's basically a term used to define multiple global crises, all interrelated and occurring at the same time. So it's actually interesting that all of these things that can cause a famine are said to occur in the last days, and specifically in that last 7-year tribulation period. Jesus spoke about the last days, and he said this, Matthew 24, 6-8, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. He says, for nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. And when we look at the first judgments that are seen in the book of Revelation, we see that all of these come. Revelation 6, 3 to 8, it says, when the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. And to him was given a large sword. And when the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. And I looked, and before me was a black horse, and its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. And then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine. And when the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. And I looked, and there before me was a pale horse, and its rider was death, and Hades was following close behind him. And there was given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So we see that peace is taken from the earth in the second seal judgment, and this is quickly followed by famine conditions in the third. And here the rider of this black horse is said to hold a pair of scales in his hand. So the imagery is of weighing food in the scales, and it indicates a scarcity of food, famine. And by the fourth seal, it was said that power was given to kill a fourth of the earth by the sword, famine, and plague and pestilence. Now, food is power. Even today, there are key families and corporations that control much of the food, especially across the United States, but also in the world. Bill Gates has actually recently become the largest private landowner in the United States. And one article that I read spoke about the pressure on family-owned farms. It said this, "This is not just happening in America. It is happening all over the world. Gates and his globalist allies at the WEF are seeking to snuff out the family-owned competition by pressing for regulations and restrictions on the tried and true methods of producing food across the globe." And the farmer protests, it says, in countries such as the Netherlands, Canada and Ireland, which recently announced the imminent slaughter of between 41,000 and 200,000 cows, demonstrate that the food industry takeover is a global problem. Add to that, we could say that there are a handful of corporations that control over 50% of the world's seeds, and thus controlling the global food supply. So simply put, if you can control food, you can control the people. Food production is big business, and they want it controlled by the few. So always remember that in Genesis, it begins with the food supply. That's what fails first. Control the food, and you can control the people. But let's carry on. Verses 14 and 15 in Genesis 47. It says, and Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they had brought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and they said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. So what happens next in Joseph's famine? First the food failed and then the money failed. As food became scarce, its value rose, and the people spent all that they had just to live. And we actually see this in the passage from Revelation 6 that I quoted earlier, where we read, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages." A quart of wheat was enough for one meal for one person. So the Bible is showing that in the coming days, that people will work all day for enough to pay for one meal. And what about the other meals? And what about the rest of your family? So an interesting phrase is actually used here in Genesis, saying that the money failed. Can money fail? Oh yeah, money can fail. You may have a large number next to your bank account, but its purchasing power can be diminished through inflation to the point that it's basically worthless. You know, it's been said that in the time of the worst hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 1920s, you were better off burning your cash to get some warmth than trying to buy coal and wood with it. Let me just give you a few other kind of mind-blowing facts about what happened in the 1920s in the Weimar Republic. It says prices ran out of control. For example, a loaf of bread, which cost 250 marks in January 1923, had risen to 200,000 million marks in November 1923. So the same year, it's gone from 250 marks to 200,000 million marks. That's hyperinflation. It says by autumn 1923, it cost more to print a note than the note was worth. It says during the crisis, workers were often paid twice a day. Okay, you might get paid weekly, fortnightly, monthly. These people were getting paid twice a day because prices rose so fast that their wages were virtually worthless by lunchtime. So you might think, well, how did the Weimar Republic get to such a state? Well, they thought that they could just print money to get out of their troubles. And yeah, that's pretty similar to what the Western world has been doing for some time. Let me just quote again about this time, because I find it kind of fascinating. This is from Britannica.com. It says, "The rising cost of goods, combined with a dramatic increase in the money supply, created perfect conditions for inflation. Before World War I, the exchange rate was just over 4 marks to the US dollar. By 1920, the value of the mark was 16 times less. It stabilized at 69 marks to the dollar for some months. And the Weimar government was still in a position to get a grip on the economy. Instead, it chose to print yet more money in order to pay the reparation debt. And by July 1922, prices had risen by some 700%, and hyperinflation, with too much money chasing goods that were far too scarce, had arrived." And it says the government had to print million mark notes, then billion mark notes. And by November 1923, one US dollar was equivalent to 1,000 billion or a trillion marks. It says famously it was observed at the time that a wheelbarrow full of money could not buy a newspaper. It said shopkeepers could not replenish their stock fast enough to keep up with prices. Farmers refused to sell their produce for worthless money. Food riots broke out, pensioners starved, and townspeople marched into the countryside to loot the farms. Law and order broke down, and the German attempt at democracy had been completely undermined. Conspiracy theories sprouted and extremist political views became acceptable as Wymer's currency became valueless to the point of meaninglessness, and ultimately hyperinflation enabled Adolf Hitler to gain power. So you'll note that last sentence, ultimately hyperinflation enabled Adolf Hitler to gain power. The craziness and the desperation of the day led to the rise of a man who said he could fix it all, and most believed him. And so it shall be again. Now in the days of Joseph in ancient Egypt, they couldn't just print more notes, and nor could countries just run up large debts with the World Bank with little intention to ever pay it back, like we do now. So when the money was gone, it was gone. The money had failed. Food became too scarce, too expensive, and the people's money was all used up trying to survive. That didn't mean that there was no money. It simply meant that the collective wealth of Canaan, Egypt, and the other countries went into Pharaoh's treasury. So what came next? Verses 16 and 17 says, "Then Joseph said, 'Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone.' So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for their horses, flocks, cattle, herds, and donkeys. Thus they fed them with bread, he fed them with bread, in exchange for all their livestock that year." So again, first the food fails, then the money fails. What comes next? Their possessions failed. Once they'd run out of money, they turned to what they owned. Joseph gave the people bread in exchange for all of their horses and cattle and flocks. So they had food that year. But remember, this is a 7-year long famine. And with their money and their livestock now gone, what was left once the food ran out at the end of the year? The scripture tells us what happened next. Verses 18 to 20, it says, "When that year had ended, they came to him the next year and they said, 'We will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. My Lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, and the land may not be desolate.' Then Joseph brought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's." So when the year ended, they had to return to Joseph once again. They acknowledged, we've lost everything. All our money's gone, livestock's all gone. They'd already exchanged that with Joseph for grain. What did they have left? Well, they only had two things left to sell: their land and themselves. And so their suggestion to Joseph was to buy us and our land for bread. In other words, they will own nothing, not even their own freedom. You know, the introduction to the American Constitution begins with those famous words, "We the people," and the government was established to serve the people. But what we see here in Genesis, again as a picture of the time of the end, is when the people have become once again the servants of the state. And we know from other passages in Revelation that in the end, people will not even be able to buy and sell without first selling their own soul to this coming world dictator. That's how bad it will get. And what else do we see in Genesis? In 21 it says, "And as for the people, he moved them into cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end." So what happens next when the people own nothing and become servants of the state? Well, they're now moved into cities so they can be more easily managed. Now, I should point out at this stage that Joseph did these things to save their lives because the conditions were terrible and he wanted to be able to manage and bring the Egyptians through it. He didn't have bad intentions. But this is a picture of what is coming with a leader who doesn't have such good intentions. So I couldn't help but notice that the people were all moved into cities at this time. And there is certainly a big rural to urban push underway. To quote just a couple of statistics, it says the United Nations also recently projected that nearly all global population growth from 2017 to 2030 will be by cities, with about 1.1 billion new urbanites over the next 10 years. And also said by 2050, 70% of the world's population will live in cities, up from 54% in 2020. And for the urbanites, the push is for 15-minute cities. You may have heard of that term. That is, they want to design cities to provide all the necessities of life within a 15-minute travel radius from your home. Now, that sounds all right, you know. Doesn't sound too bad. Who wants to travel further than they have to? But with that comes other desires to control where you can go and how far you can go, how often you can travel, all in the name of climate change, of course. You combine that with a global digital ID and the tracking of where you go and what you buy and what you can buy, and you have the ultimate system of control. All right, let's read just the last few verses, 22 to 26. See what else happened in the days of Joseph. It says, only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their lands. Then Joseph said to the people, indeed, I have brought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land, and it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and for your food, and those of your households, and as food for your little ones. And so they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. So there's just a few last points to note from this passage as we sort of get close to ending this message. Firstly, there was a priestly class that was exempt. You know, the priests in Egypt were given special status by Pharaoh, and they were given food to eat. They did not have to sell their lands. And I think it's just a little pointer to the fact there will always be a so-called elite that are exempt from the troubles in the world. And when I quoted earlier from the famine of the third seal of Revelation 6, you may remember that it said, and do not damage the oil and the wine. So it's indicating that there will still be the luxuries for the elite during this time, for those that actually control the food and have the power. The second point from this passage is that a new tax was implemented. So having sold their property, the people did still get to work the land, but they were working it for someone else. They didn't own it anymore. So they now had to pay a new tax of 20% of its produce back to Pharaoh. This is actually the first recorded tax system in Scripture. And the third point just to note is that the passage ends with the people owning nothing yet seemingly happy. Why was that? because they still had their lives. And so they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And again, I am not saying that this was a bad system at the time. As mentioned earlier, Joseph did this to save their lives, and they were indeed saved in the midst of the most extreme famine. The people lost everything, but they were still grateful to keep their life. But it is, like I've mentioned, a prophetic pointer. Joseph was a godly leader, but one will come in that same position of power, and godly is not how you would describe him. So, as we conclude, what have we seen? What was the order that is given to go from prosperous living to owning nothing? Firstly, famine causes the food to fail in the land. Secondly, the money then failed as food became scarce and prices increased. Hyperinflation. Thirdly, possessions were then lost as they had to be sold to survive. Fourthly, the land that the people owned was then sold. And soon the people became slaves themselves to the state. Fifthly, the people were then moved into cities to be managed more easily. Sixthly, the people then work the land, but they don't own it, and they pay a tax to Pharaoh. And it ends with the people kind of happy, or at least grateful, to still at least have their life. So this is pretty full-on passage, I know, especially when seen in the light of what is to come. You know, and probably a lot of people would give financial advice right about now. I mean, there's obvious things that could be said, like as much as possible, stay out of debt or live within your means and try to purchase needs and not wants, and maybe to diversify any savings that you may have physical assets, not just money in the bank that can be easily inflated away. But to be fair, financial advice is not really my focus and never has been. And while the Bible does talk about and give financial advice, its emphasis is really on spiritual and eternal riches. And that's where my focus is. Because our hope should be on the heavenly city and the eternal home to come. So I just want to leave you with a few thoughts, a few things to note as we close this message. Firstly, Jesus was crystal clear about where we should lay up our treasures. Matthew 6:19-21, he says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." He also told us to watch our hearts, especially when it comes to greed and possessions, and to be rich towards God. In Luke 12:15, it says, "He said to them, 'Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because life does not consist in the abundance of possessions.'" James actually tells us about the loss of wealth in the last days. He says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl, for your miseries are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. And you have heaped up treasure in the last days." And Proverbs tells us that there is something far more important than wealth when judgment comes. Proverbs 11:4 says, "Wealth is worthless in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death." And finally, the Lord, through the prophet Jeremiah, tells us what to ultimately put our hope and our glory in and to value. Jeremiah 9:23-24 says, "Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, let not the mighty man glory in his might, nor let the rich man glory in his riches. But let him who glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord, exercising loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these I delight, says the Lord." And one last promise that we should always remember for believers, for the true church. We don't know how many of these birth pains that I've kind of been speaking about and Jesus spoke about we shall see, but we will not see his wrath in that tribulation period. His promise to believers is this: "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth." So again, we don't know how bad things will come before the rapture, but our hope is on his coming. And as things do become more difficult, because they are said to be more difficult in the last days, far more difficult, the light and the hope of heaven will grow all the stronger, all the more real. And God will work to bring many to himself as well. That's the blessing of difficult days. So thank you for listening. Bit of a different message, I know. But I hope that it's been a blessing for you and it's helped you to think again of what really, really matters, eternal matters. May God bless you.